on short and long documentaries, all the different films, this terrible, really, moment for you, but also trying to redeem it somehow. Your final thoughts?
I just hope that this film draws attention to the work that my brother did. You know, Brent cared about people caught in the middle of these conflicts around the world. And, you know, as we enter another war, I think about all the civilians that are going to be hurt and impacted. I think about the soldiers that are going to be killed and their families. And I hope Brent's work and the work of all the fallen journalists helps people pause for a minute and think about the impact that these wars will have.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Craig Renaud, director and producer of Armed Only with a Camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renaud, about his brother Brent, killed 4 years ago this month in Ukraine. The film's been nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short. Voting for the Oscars by members of the Academy ends tonight. That does it for our show. To see the full interviews we've done over the years with Craig, with Brent, with all the Oscar-nominated filmmakers, you can go to democracynow.org. On Saturday, I'll be in Savannah, Georgia, at the Hindsight Film Festival for a screening of the award-winning documentary Steal the Story, Please, about the 30 years of Democracy Now! I look forward to seeing folks in Savannah, Georgia on Saturday night at 7. Check our website at democracynow.org for details. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Nicole Salazar, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Safwat Nizal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Karl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Coming Monday, March 16th at 11 p.m., Gremlin Time presents a suspense double feature.
You're alone and unarmed in the green hell of a Caribbean jungle. You're being trailed by a mad hunter who believes that you, a human being, are the most dangerous game.
Paul Frees and Hans Connery star in this adaptation of The Most Dangerous Game. Also, The Mask of Demetrios, starring Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre.
Let's put down a date. Istanbul, Turkey, 1938.
Monday, March 16th, 11 p.m., Gremlin Time.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, new rights are on the way for Oregon immigrants who need emergency medical care. Northwest lawmakers react to Trump's reassignment of Kristi Noem, and a new challenger enters the race against a longtime Oregon U.S. senator. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 5th, 2026. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Healthcare and immigrants' rights advocates are celebrating the passage of the Healthcare Without Fear Act through Oregon's House and Senate. Now heading to the governor's desk, this measure would limit how much access federal immigration agents have to Oregon hospitals when they're bringing in detainees, Isabel Charlet reports.
A bill that would restrict federal immigration agents' behavior in Oregon hospitals has cleared the state House and Senate and will likely become law. Supporters say the Healthcare Without Fear Act would ensure ICE agents are held to the same standards as state and local law enforcement inside hospitals. Ellie Murray is a critical care nurse and member of the Oregon Nurses Association, which helped write the bill. She says since the Trump administration ended sensitive location protections last year, ICE officers have been interfering with care and intimidating patients and workers when bringing in detainees for treatment.
They're not respecting the private areas of the hospital. It's been reported to me that they were looking at logs of incoming patients. They are asking providers, in some cases, to discharge patients before they're ready to be discharged.
The bill would require hospitals to designate a point person for interacting with ICE officers and safeguard patients' immigration information by creating clear private and public areas. It would also protect healthcare workers who share immigration resources with patients. The measure is now heading to Governor Tina Kotek's desk. Oregon Senate Republicans say they are concerned the measure would place further strain on hospitals already struggling with tight budgets and staffing shortages. Murray counters that hospitals already have policies in place for how to interact with local law enforcement, and the bill would require the same thing for ICE agents.
We're not adding any additional burden in terms of staff. I don't know what's more important than protecting patients' rights.
Murray says although there have not been many examples of ICE agents interfering in hospitals, the state needs to be prepared. I'm Isabel Charlet.
President Trump is firing Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and replacing her with Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, a Republican from Oklahoma. He says Mullen will take the job as of March 31st. Trump thanked Noem for her service, stating the former South Dakota governor has, quote, served us well. Though Noem is leaving his cabinet, Trump has appointed her as a special envoy for the Shield of the Americas, a new security initiative focused on the Western Hemisphere. Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden posted his response, quote, turns out lawlessness is not a winning strategy. See you at Nuremberg 2.0. This comes after contentious hearings in both the House and Senate with Noem. A Pacific Northwest congresswoman had a sharp line of questioning. Washington Representative Pramila Jayapal confronted Kristi Noem during a congressional hearing in which many other members of Congress also criticized the secretary's job performance.
I've sent you three different letters going back to February of 2025, raising concerns that you are unlawfully detaining U.S. citizens in violation of the Fourth Amendment. It was not until yesterday afternoon, more than a year after I sent you my first letter, that I finally received a response from you stating that ICE has detained 18 U.S. citizens. I want to introduce you to just four of the U.S. citizens unlawfully detained by ICE who are not even included in the 18 individuals that you cite in your response to me. They're in this room with us. Patricia O'Keefe was monitoring ICE agents when they deployed pepper spray into her car vent without provocation. They smashed her car windows, pulled her and her friend out, arrested them for, quote, obstruction, and detained them. Patricia saw an entire area dedicated to detaining U.S. citizens. An ICE agent also said, quote, you guys have to stop obstructing us. That's why that lesbian bitch is dead, end quote. Referring to Renee Good, ICE detained Patricia for over 8 hours. Ryan Eklund was monitoring ICE activity in his car when ICE agents blocked him and took his photo, then appeared to use that photo to go to his neighborhood and try to intimidate him. He was still in the car when they pulled him from his car and put him in leg irons. Ryan was detained for 6 hours. ICE agents shot Wesley Powers with a pepper ball while he was peacefully protesting ICE activity. ICE detained him for 8 hours, gave him no medical assistance, leaving him in clothes that still had dangerous chemical residue. When doctors examined Wesley after his release, the medical professional opinion was that what ICE agents did to him was assault. Edmund Higgins is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. While legally observing ICE, he honked his horn, and when he saw agents driving down a narrow road, he actually drove away. But agents chased him until he sought refuge at a local police station. When agents drew their firearms and pointed them at Edmund, well-trained local police officers defused the situation, but your agents still insisted on detaining Edmund for 6 hours. Secretary Noem, in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, you stated that ICE agents may arrest U.S. citizens in the situation where they were obstructing law enforcement or in situations where you have reasons to doubt that they're U.S. citizens. Is that still your position?
I said or probable cause.
So let me ask each of the U.S. citizens in the audience who were detained, raise your hand if you were not charged with any crime following your detention. Not a single one of you were charged with a crime. Now raise your hand if any of you were not even asked to prove that you were U.S. citizens during your detention. Not a single one of you were even asked about your citizenship status, making it clear that DHS agents simply don't care that they're arresting U.S. citizens. Now please raise your hand if you were detained by ICE simply for legally protesting or monitoring ICE activity under your First Amendment rights. All four U.S. citizens have raised their hands. These are not four isolated incidents. ProPublica's reporting puts the number at over 170 U.S. citizens detained in just the first 8 months of the administration, which doesn't even include Minnesota. None of these four U.S. citizens were charged with a crime. None had their citizenship questioned, and all were lawfully exercising their First Amendment rights. Do you have anything you want to say to them or the millions of American citizens across the country that are watching this and horrified at what your department is doing?
Context is critical in each of these situations to know the full range of what happened in each of these situations before and after the incident and their arrest.
Secretary, not a single one was charged with a crime. Not a single one, and they were detained. And let me just reclaim my time. Yours is a case of failed leadership, Secretary. You need to resign, be fired, or be impeached.
That was Washington Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal questioning Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem in a congressional hearing. And a global humanitarian group says innocent civilians are paying the highest price for the U.S. and Israel's evolving war with Iran. It's pleading with national leaders and troops on the ground to make preserving human life a number one priority. Mike Moen has that story.
The war's initial stages resulted in the deaths of several U.S. military members, and there are estimates from human rights trackers that suggest at least 1,000 civilians were killed in the crossfire. Separately, Anna Zaros with Nonviolent Peace Force says their head of mission in northern Iraq describes the spillover effect in that region, people afraid to go to work, school, or even sleep through the night.
Airspaces and roads are closed, missiles are flying overhead in all directions, and rumors of new attacks are spreading. And the first thing people lose is their sense of safety.
Zaros says escalating bomb attacks also derail progress her group is making to build trust between community members in areas marred by past conflict. I'm Mike Moen.
Senate Republicans voted overwhelmingly yesterday against their resolution seeking to rein in Trump, though several say they're concerned about the lack of a clear game plan to end the conflict. From the U.S. Senate floor, Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray shared her thoughts on the Iran war.
Donald Trump promised lower costs and no more foreign wars. Instead, he has given us higher costs and a new costly war in the Middle East. It is hard to imagine a more straightforward betrayal. This president sent our kids into a war of choice from his beach club in Florida without clear objectives or any sense of an end game, and without any authorization from Congress, no debate, no public hearings, no justification to the American people. My thoughts go out to the families of the service members who have already been killed in Trump's war. What Americans want is health care. They want to pay less at the grocery store and the gas station. They do not want to spend billions in taxpayer dollars to bomb Iran in a war that already tragically resulted in the deaths of American service members. Congress should end this war now. Republicans should grow a spine and vote with Democrats, but instead, some Republicans are now trying to use Trump's reckless war of choice in Iran as a new pretext to completely ignore Donald Trump's reckless occupation of American cities with rogue ICE agents. Look, I'm not going to vote to fund ICE and let them detain, brutalize, shoot, or kill more American citizens just because Donald Trump started an unconstitutional war that no one asked for. And let's be clear, when it does come to national security, the Pentagon, CIA, law enforcement, the FBI, and other key agencies are already funded. And if Republicans want to know who is actually undermining our cyber defenses and our counterterrorism work, all they have to do is look at Kristi Noem's DHS and Kash Patel's FBI. How many key personnel has Trump already fired for no reason at our top cyber defense agency? How many FBI agents are focused on helping round up farm workers with no criminal history instead of counterterrorism? Why did Patel just last week fire members of the FBI's counterintelligence squad? And why on earth was a 22-year-old hired to lead counterterrorism at DHS? That should be a bigger concern to Republicans than a simple demand that ICE follow the same standards as local police. War should be a last resort. I voted against the war in Iraq, and even the Bush administration was not as cavalier as Trump about the cost of war in lives or in taxpayer dollars. Trump's war will easily cost more than it would have cost to extend the ACA tax credits. This president and this Republican Congress have shown the American people there's always money for war, there's always money for billionaire tax breaks. It is just everyday Americans who are struggling with their health care or groceries who Republicans just can't spare a dime.
That was Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray. And just ahead of the War Powers Resolution vote in the U.S. Senate, Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley spoke out.
Do we still have a Constitution that means anything? The power of war. The Constitution assigns that power directly to Congress. Madison noted the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it. The Constitution has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question in the legislature. And yet, President Trump just launched a war. He didn't call it a strike or a limited strike. He launched a war. He called it a war. It is a war. It was a surprise attack. I was thinking about how we felt when Japan launched a surprise attack on Hawaii. Now we've done that to Iran. And we did it while we were saying the negotiations are going very well. And yet we launched a surprise, devastating attack that the president says he will pursue for week after week until the job is done. But what is the job? There was no imminent threat to the United States of America. Marco Rubio has clarified there was an imminent threat, and that the imminent threat was that Israel was going to strike Iran, and Iran would retaliate against bases in the region, so we had to go to war. Are we now such an enfeebled nation that Israel decides when we go to war, and we couldn't just say to Netanyahu, hell no, you're not going to strike Iran? Are we like the puppy dog on the leash held by Bibi Netanyahu? Is that what has become of the great United States of America? We're in the middle of negotiations that are going quite well to end the threat that Iran poses in developing nuclear weapons. And by the way, they aren't developing nuclear weapons. We had a diplomatic path that was pretty phenomenal. Now, shouldn't it always be diplomacy before war? And we had diplomacy, setting out an agreement in which Iran dismantled its plutonium reactor and filled it with concrete, in which they exported all of their more highly enriched uranium outside of Iran, an agreement in which so much was removed and so many inspectors were present to make sure that there was no nuclear weapon program. But who tore up that treaty? The same man who just launched a war in violation of the Constitution of the United States. You know, when Madison spoke and said the executive is the branch of power most interested in war, he's talking about the fact that a head of state may want to write their name in history by conquering land, and that so often those justifications are not in the interest of the country as a whole. And therefore, there has to be a debate of the representatives of the country as a whole as to whether to engage in such a war. That was the wisdom, with studied care, the founders invested in this chamber. I powerfully disagreed with President George W. Bush's war on Iraq. It was justified by an argument that there were weapons of mass destruction. And the inspectors in Iraq said, we will go anywhere and look at anything that you, the United States, think that there is a depot of weapons of mass destruction. And the Bush administration said, well, you're not looking in the right places. But at least George W. Bush came to Congress in 2002 and said, I want an authorization for the use of military force because I'm concerned about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I do not think Congress reached the right decision on that day, but at least as the founders intended, it was debated here in this chamber. There has been no debate on an authorization for the use of military force, as there should have been, and as the president should have requested. And I hope, had we had such a debate, we would have come to a better, wiser conclusion than our predecessors did back in 2002. This is an extraordinarily dangerous moment for America, because we have a president who has repeatedly shredded the Constitution. He shredded it on taxation powers allocated to Congress by the Constitution. He shredded it by canceling the power of the purse assigned programs that are developed by the Congress and ending them without authorization. And now he shredded it by going to war in Iran without an authorization for the use of military force. We should say, Mr. President, if you want that power, come and put before us a proposal for the authorization for military force so that it will be properly debated in advance. Presidents squander the blood of our children and the wealth of our nation. Think about how many people died in Afghanistan and Iraq. Think about the 8,000 who died. How about the 50,000 who were so seriously injured? How about the $8 trillion? Blood and purse.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. The Democrat is facing a new challenger for the job, as KBOO's Josh Salem reports.
A conservative Southern Oregon state senator just announced that he would seek the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate. David Brock Smith, a Republican from Port Orford, has his work cut out for him. Jeff Merkley, who is running for another U.S. term, has held his Senate seat since being elected in 2008. Oregon has not elected a Republican to the U.S. Senate since 2002, and only two members of the GOP have won statewide races since 2000. In addition, the upcoming midterm elections are expected to heavily lean towards Democrats nationwide, as that party is hoping to capitalize on discontent with Donald Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress. Smith's announcement cited his experience as a former leader of Port Orford's Chamber of Commerce and in local governments at the city and county levels, saying he has worked to balance budgets and support residents and businesses. He said in a statement, quote, Oregonians are tired of partisan bickering, political grandstanding, and headlines that produce nothing but noise. I've never operated that way. As your next United States Senator, I won't start now. My focus will be squarely on the people of Oregon. I'll fight to make everyday life more affordable for working families, restore safety to our streets, address addiction and homelessness with accountability, and ensure every Oregonian's voice is heard and respected in Washington. End quote. Smith served in the Oregon House for about 6 years and made it to the Oregon Senate when local county commissioners appointed him in 2023 to fill the coastal Senate seat of Republican Dallas Hurd, who had resigned. Smith has developed a reputation in Salem for working across the aisle. He is a member of the bipartisan Oregon Legislative Sportsman's Caucus, which advocates for protecting hunting, recreational shooting, trapping, and fishing, and of the bipartisan Coastal Caucus. There is little downside for Smith to run for the position. Since his state term ends in 2029, he does not have to forfeit his position in the legislature in order to try for the U.S. Senate. Smith currently represents Oregon's 1st Senate District, which encompasses Curry County, as well as portions of Coos, Jackson, and Douglas counties. It is heavily leaned in favor of the GOP historically. Smith himself has sometimes taken positions to the right of his Republican colleagues. For instance, he has claimed that human actions do not contribute to climate change, despite widespread scientific consensus to the contrary. Smith also signed onto a letter urging then Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum to join the state of Texas in its 2020 lawsuit seeking to overturn the results of that year's presidential election in 4 battleground states. After being included in a group indirectly accused of complicity in the violence surrounding the January 6th insurrection, Smith clarified that he had already accepted President-elect Biden, but he told Willamette Week that he supports any individual's right to peacefully protest. He did condemn, quote, unlawful riots and acts of violence. Smith also asked voters in a 2025 bill to decide whether to repeal the state's decades-old mail voting law. So far, Smith's state Senate campaign has accumulated more than $50,000 in cash. He did not immediately respond to a text message requesting an interview, and he did not respond when asked about the top issues he was prioritizing as a candidate. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Texas Republicans brace for Trump's Senate endorsement as voters express frustration with polling place changes. The Supreme Court will issue a major voting rights ruling, and Idaho rejects federal attempts to access voter data. Here are some of the stories impacting our democracy in today's edition of 2026 Talks.
I refuse to allow a flawed, self-centered, and shameless candidate like Ken Paxton risk everything we've worked so hard to build over these many years. There is simply too much at stake in this midterm election for our state and for our country.
Incumbent Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn says the gloves are staying off for his late May primary runoff against MAGA darling State Attorney General Ken Paxton. Neither Cornyn nor Paxton reached 50% in Tuesday's vote. President Donald Trump says he will endorse one of them and the other should drop out. Cornyn is powerful in the Senate and a major figure in the state's conservative politics. But Southern Methodist University political scientist Cal Gilson says he's seen as a traditional Republican.
The Bush wing has faded and the MAGA wing of the party is in the saddle. So the question is whether Cornyn can survive, because Paxton is seen as more of a knife fighter who will toe the Republican line and follow Donald Trump and the MAGA base of the party.
Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, who was bested by State Representative James Tallarico in a close Democratic primary, called for unity. Embattled South Texas Republican Congressman Tony Gonzalez has admitted he had an affair with an aide who died after setting herself on fire last year. Gonzalez is also headed to a runoff after failing to get 50% in Tuesday's vote. The Dallas County Republican Party closed two countywide voting centers, meaning some people were turned away on Election Day. Idaho is the latest state to reject Justice Department demands for unredacted voter data. The DOJ says it's needed to stop non-citizen voting, but Idaho's Republican Secretary of State says that's virtually non-existent, and turning over voter rolls would violate privacy rules. Watchdogs say a looming Supreme Court decision could end up disenfranchising voters of color. Louisiana versus Calais may decide if race can be considered in redistricting. Neelu Jenks with Fair Vote Washington says the state's Yakima County drew a majority Latino district 5 years ago after a court ruled it had been diluting minority voting power. She says it could be at risk.
This is a fundamentally important decision to the very fabric of how much change has happened in our nation since 1965. These are rights that took generations to win. They can be undone by a handful of decisions.
Montana GOP Senator Steve Daines says he's retiring. Six Republicans and four Democrats have announced they won't seek re-election to the chamber. I'm Zimon Perez.
Groups concerned about wildlife are suing to stop the Trump administration's rollbacks of protections for the sage grouse. In 2015, the Obama administration created protections for the bird, which has habitat primarily in the western U.S., including Oregon and Washington. Suzanne Potter reports.
Environmental groups filed suit this week against the Trump administration to restore protections for the sage grouse. President Donald Trump tried to weaken the protections during his first term, but he was stopped by the courts. He then stripped them away again last December. Olivia Tanager is director of the Toyabe chapter of the Sierra Club, a plaintiff in the suit. She argues the health of the broader ecosystem is at stake.
So we know that sage grouse are the barometer of the sagebrush sea, and when their habitat is dismantled piece by piece, the entire ecosystem follows.
Other species in the habitat include pygmy rabbits, pronghorns, elk, mule deer, golden eagles, and native trout. The sage grouse population has declined by more than 80% in the past 60 years. The Trump administration has said the regulations are onerous and threaten commercial activities like grazing, mining, and oil and gas exploration. Attorney Sarah Stelberg is with Advocates for the West, a public interest environmental law firm representing plaintiffs in the suit. She says grazing on federal public lands endangers the sage grouse and makes the whole area more vulnerable to wildfire.
Grazing is a threat because livestock can eliminate cover that young sage grouse need to hide from predators. Also, their hooves disrupt the natural soil crust, which leads to invasion of cheatgrass, which leads to greater wildfires.
The administration's plan removed protections from 11 million acres of sage-grouse habitat. It also smooths the path for new oil and gas leasing and says developers no longer have to offset harm to the birds. Other plaintiffs include the Center for Biological Diversity, Western Watersheds Project, Gallatin Wildlife Association, Rocky Mountain Wild, and Wild Earth Guardians. I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new report features the role of sovereignty in tribal broadband rights, and old-growth forests are vulnerable to severe wildfires and need native stewards. Here's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
A new report by the Urban Institute based in Washington, D.C. is looking closely at Native American tribes and their continued challenges with broadband infrastructure. KUNM's Jeanette Didios spoke with Amanda Hermans, a research associate for the report, on how sovereignty comes into play.
Herman says, as sovereign nations, Native American tribes have the right to govern their own digital infrastructure, which in the past wasn't possible.
This was rooted in a history of not having the ability to take sovereignty over their access to things like broadband and other utilities.
Herman said, broadband providers in the past have not allowed tribes a seat at the table when it comes to making decisions on how to serve their communities with internet. But she says that's changing, and tribes are building expertise in broadband construction and taking back control of these plans. But that doesn't mean they have to do it by themselves.
Some tribes, depending, on their priorities, may not have the desire or the capacity to do that all themselves. And there's also a lot to be gained by partnering with knowledgeable industry experts and maybe contracting out some of those services or roles to bolster their capacity.
She says building broadband infrastructure on tribal lands is crucial on many levels and can help bring in revenue and create jobs for tribal members. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
Old growth forests with just modest exposure to fire are now most at risk for severe wildfires. That's from scientists from Oregon State University and the USDA Forest Service. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, most of the problem is lack of native stewardship.
Researchers say three-fourths of the Pacific Northwest forests that historically saw low and mixed severity fires are highly vulnerable to devastating blazes today. Part of this vulnerability came after indigenous people were driven out and therefore unable to practice controlled burns to reduce slash and pests as well as rejuvenate the landscape. OSU fire ecologist